our childhood. What the fuck do you want, Lenu? I'm like this because I lost my daughter, and maybe she's alive, maybe she's dead, but I can't bear either of those possibilities. Because if she's alive, she's alive far away from me. She's in a place where horrible things are happening to her, which I see clearly. I see them all day and all night, as if they were happening right before my eyes. But if she's dead, I'm dead too. Dead, here inside. A death more unbearable than real death, which is death without feeling. While this death forces you to feel everything, every day, to wake up, wash, dress, eat and drink, work, talk to you who don't understand or won't understand. To you who, even if I just see you, all set, fresh from the hairdresser, with your daughters who do well in school, who always do everything perfectly, who aren't spoiled even by this place of shit, which rather seems to do them good, makes them even more confident, even more arrogant, even more sure they have the right to take everything. All this makes me more furious than I already was. So go. Go. Leave me in peace. Tina would have been better than all of you, and instead they took her, and I can't bear it anymore. I would have liked to lead her into a conversation like that, jumbled, intoxicated. I felt that if she made up her mind, she would extract from the tangled mass of her brain words of that sort. But it didn't happen. In fact, as I think back, in that phase she was less aggressive than in other periods of our story. Maybe the outburst I hoped for was made up of my own feelings, which therefore hindered me from seeing the situation clearly and made Leela even more elusive. Sometimes I wondered if she had in her mind something unutterable that I wasn't even capable of imagining. 10. Sundays were the worst. Leela stayed home, she didn't work, and from outside came the holiday voices. I went down, I said, let's go out. Let's take a walk to the center. Let's go to the sea. She refused, and got angry if I was too insistent. So, to make up for her rudeness, Enzo said, I'll go. Come on. She shouted immediately, yes, go. Leave me in peace. I'll take a bath and wash my hair. Let me breathe. We would go out. My daughters came with us, and sometimes also Gennaro, who, after the death of his uncle, we all called Reno. During those hours of our walks, Enzo confided in me, in his laconic, sometimes obscure way. He said that without Tina, he didn't know what the point of making money was. He said that stealing children to make their parents suffer was a sign of the wretched times that were coming. He said that after the birth of his daughter, it was as if a light had switched on in his head, and now the light had gone out. He said,
you remember when, right here, on this street, I carried her on my shoulders?
He said,
thank you, Lenu, for the help you give us. Don't be angry with Leela. This is a time of tribulation, but you know her better than I do. Sooner or later, she'll recover.
I listened. I asked him, she's very pale. Physically, how is she?
I meant, I know she is tortured by grief, but tell me, is she healthy? Have you noticed worrying symptoms? But in the face of physically, Enzo was embarrassed. He knew almost nothing about Leela's body. He adored it as one adores an idol, warily and with respect. And he answered without conviction, fine. Then he grew nervous. He was in a hurry to get home. He said, let's try to persuade her at least to take a short walk in the neighborhood. Useless. Only very rarely could I get Leela outside on a Sunday, but it wasn't a good idea. She walked quickly, carelessly dressed, her hair loose and disheveled, flashing angry glances. My daughters and I followed haltingly behind her, supportive, like handmaidens more beautiful, more richly adorned than our mistress. Everyone knew her, even the peddlers, who remembered the troubles they had had because of Tina's disappearance, and, afraid there could be others, avoided her. To everyone, she was the terrifying woman who, stricken by a great misfortune, carried its potency with her, spreading it wherever she went. Lila walked along the stradone with her fierce gaze toward the gardens, and people lowered their eyes, looked in another direction. But even if someone greeted her, she paid no attention and didn't respond. From the way she walked, she seemed to have an urgent goal. The truth is, she was running from the memory of that Sunday 2 years earlier. When we went out together, we inevitably met the Saladas. Lately, they hadn't been straying from the neighborhood much. There had been a lengthy list of people murdered in Naples, and, at least on Sundays, they preferred to remain peacefully on the streets of their childhood that for them were as safe as a fortress. The two families always did the same things. They went to mass, they walked amid the stalls, they brought their children to the neighborhood library, which, by long tradition, since the days when Lila and I were young, was open on Sundays. I thought it must be Elisa or Giliola who imposed that educated ritual. But once, when I stopped to exchange a few words, I discovered that it was Michele. He said, pointing to his children, who, although they were grown, obeyed him, evidently out of fear, while they had no respect for their mother. "They know that if they don't read at least one book a month, from the first page to the last, I won't give them a lira. I'm doing the right thing, no, Lenu?" I don't know if they really took out books. They had enough money to buy the entire Biblioteca Nazionale. But whether they did it out of real need or as a performance, they now had this habit. They went up the stairs, pushed open the glass door, a relic of the 40s, went in, stayed for no more than 10 minutes, and came out. When I was alone with my daughters, Marcello, Michele, Giliola, and the boys, too, were cordial. Only my sister was cool. With Lila, on the other hand, things were complicated, and I was afraid that the tension would rise dangerously. But on those very rare Sunday walks, she always pretended that they didn't exist. And the Saladas behaved the same way, and since I was with Lila, they preferred to ignore me as well. Elsa, however, one Sunday morning, decided not to follow that unwritten rule, and with her Queen of Hearts manners, greeted the children of Michele and Giliola, who responded uneasily. As a result, although it was very cold, we were forced to stop for a few minutes. The two Saladas pretended to have urgent things to talk about with each other. I spoke to Giliola, the girls to the boys. Ima studied her cousin Silvio attentively, since we saw him so infrequently. No one addressed a word to Lila, and Lila, for her part, was silent. Only Michele, when he broke off his conversation with his brother and spoke to me in his teasing way, referred to her without looking at her. "Now, Lenu, we're going to look in at the library, and then we're going to eat. Would you like to come with us?"
"No, thank you," I said. "We have to go. Another time, though, certainly."
"Good. Then tell the boys what they should read and what they shouldn't. You are an example for us, you and your daughters. When we see you pass by on the street, we always say, 'Once, Lenucha was like us, and look how she is now. She doesn't know what pride is. She is democratic. She lives here with us, just like us, even though she's an important person.' Ah, yes, those who study become good. Today, everyone goes to school. Everyone keeps his eyes on the books, and so in the future, we'll have so much of that goodness it'll be coming out of our ears. But if you don't read and you don't study, which is what happened to Lena,
it happened to all of us, you stay malicious, and malice is ugly. Isn't it true, Lainu?
He grabbed me by the wrist. His eyes were shining. He repeated sarcastically,
Isn't it true?
And I nodded, yes. But I freed my wrist too forcefully. My mother's bracelet remained in his hand.
Oh,
he exclaimed. And this time he sought Leela's gaze, but didn't find it. He said with feigned regret,
I'm sorry. I'll have it fixed for you.
It's nothing.
Absolutely not. It's my duty. You'll have it back like new. Marche, you'll go by the jeweler's?
Marcello nodded yes. People were passing, eyes lowered. It was almost time for lunch. When we managed to get rid of the brothers, Leela said to me, You're even more defenseless than you used to be. You'll never see that bracelet again. 11. I was convinced that she was about to have one of her crises. I saw that she was debilitated and anguished, as if she expected something uncontrollable to break the building in two, the apartment, herself. For several days, knocked out by the flu, I didn't hear anything about her. Dede, too, had a cough and a fever, and I assumed that the virus would soon be transmitted to Elsa and to Ima. Also, I had an article to hand in urgently. I was supposed to do something for a magazine that was devoting an entire issue to the female body. And I didn't have the desire or strength to write. Outside, a cold wind had arisen. It shook the window panes. Blades of cold penetrated the loose frames. On Friday, Enzo came to tell me that he had to go to Avellino because an old aunt of his was ill. As for Reno, he would be spending Saturday and Sunday with Stefano, who had asked him to help dismantle the fixtures in the grocery and take them to a man who was willing to buy them. Leela, therefore, would be alone, and Enzo said that she was a little depressed. He wanted me to keep her company. But I was tired. I barely had time to focus on a thought when Dede called me. Ima wanted me. Elsa protested, and the thought vanished. When Pinuccia came to clean the house, I asked her to cook enough for Saturday and Sunday. Then I shut myself in my bedroom, where I had a table to work at. The next day, since I hadn't heard from Leela, I went down to invite her to lunch. She came to the door in sandals, an old green bathrobe over her pajamas, her hair disheveled. But to my amazement, her eyes and mouth were heavily made up. The house was a mess, and there was an unpleasant smell. She said, If the wind blows any harder, the neighborhood will fly away. Nothing but an overused hyperbole, and yet I was alarmed. She had said it as if she were convinced that the neighborhood really could be torn from its foundations and carried off to shatter near Ponte Rossi. Once she realized that I had perceived how odd her tone was, she smiled in a forced way, whispered, I was joking. I nodded. I listed the good things there were for lunch. She became excited in an exaggerated way. But a moment later, her mood abruptly changed. She said, Bring me lunch here. I don't want to come to your house. Your daughters get on my nerves. I brought her lunch and also dinner. The stairs were cold. I didn't feel well, and I didn't want to go up and down just to have unpleasant things said to me. But this time, I found her surprisingly cordial. She said, Wait. Sit with me for a moment. She drew me into the bathroom. She brushed her hair carefully, and meanwhile spoke about my daughters with tenderness, with admiration, as if to convince me that she didn't seriously believe what she had said to me earlier. At first, she said, dividing the hair into two and beginning to braid it without losing sight of her image in the mirror. Dede resembled you. Now, instead, she's becoming like her father. The opposite is happening with Elsa.
She seemed identical to her father, and now instead she's starting to look like you. Everything moves. A wish, a fantasy, travels more swiftly than blood. I don't understand. You remember when I thought Gennaro was Nino's? Yes. To me, he really seemed so. He was identical to Nino, his exact image.
You mean that a desire can be so strong as to seem fulfilled?
No. I mean that for a few years, Gennaro was truly Nino's child.
Don't exaggerate.
She stared at me spitefully for a moment. She took a few steps in the bathroom, limping. She burst out laughing in a slightly artificial way. So it seems to you that I'm exaggerating? I realized with some annoyance that she was imitating my walk. Don't make fun of me. My hip hurts. Nothing hurts, Lainu. You invented that limp in order not to let your mother die completely. And now you really do limp. And I've studied you. It's good for you. The Saladas took your bracelet and you said nothing. You weren't sorry. You weren't worried. At the time, I thought it was because you don't know how to rebel. But now, I understand it's not that. You're getting old properly. You feel strong. You stopped being a daughter. You truly became a mother. I felt uneasy. I repeated, it's just a little pain. Even pain does you good. You just needed a slight limp, and now your mother stays quietly inside you. Her leg is glad that you limp, and so you too are glad. Isn't that true? No. She gave me an ironic look to reassert that she didn't believe me, and with her made-up eyes narrowed to cracks, said, do you think that when Tina is 42, she'll be like this? I stared at her. She had a provocative expression, her hands tight around the braids. I said, it's likely, yes. Maybe so. 12. My daughters had to fend for themselves. I stayed to eat with Leela, even though I felt cold in my bones. We talked the whole time about physical resemblances. I tried to understand what was happening in her mind, but I also mentioned to her the work I was doing. Talking to you helps, I said, to give her confidence. You make me think. The idea seemed to cheer her. She said, knowing I'm useful to you, I feel better. Right afterward, thanks to the effort involved in being useful to me, she moved on to contorted or illogical arguments. She had put on a lot of powder to hide her pallor, and she didn't seem herself, but a carnival mask with very red cheeks. At times, I followed her with interest. At times, I recognized only the signs of the illness that I was well acquainted with by now and was alarmed. For example, she said, laughing, for a while, I brought up Nino's child, just as you've done with Ima, a flesh and blood child. But when that child became Stefano's, where did Nino's child go? Does Gennaro still have him inside? Do I have him? Remarks like that. She got lost. Then she started abruptly to praise my cooking. She said she had eaten with pleasure, something she hadn't done for a long time. When I said it wasn't mine but Pinucha's, she darkened. She grumbled that she didn't want anything from Pinucha. At that point, Elsa called me from the landing. She shouted that I had to come home right away. Dede with a fever was even worse than Dede healthy. I urged Leela to call me whenever she needed me. I told her to rest. I hurried up to my apartment. For the rest of the day, I tried to forget about her. I worked late into the night. The children had grown up with the idea that when I really had my back to the wall, they had to look after themselves and not disturb me. In fact, they left me in peace, and I worked well. As usual, a half-sentence of Leela's was enough, and my brain recognized her aura, became active, liberated my intelligence. By now, I knew that I could do well, especially when she, even just with a few disjointed words, assured the more insecure part of me that I was right. I gave to her digressive complaints a concise, elegant organization. I wrote about my hip, about my mother. Now that I was surrounded by admiration, I could admit, without uneasiness, that talking to her incited ideas, pushed me to make connections between distant things. In those years of being neighbors, I on the floor above, she below, it often happened. A slight push was enough, and the seemingly empty mind discovered that it was full and lively. I attributed to her a sort of far-sightedness, as I had all our lives, and I found nothing wrong with it. I said to myself that to be adult was to recognize that I needed her impulses. If once I had hidden, even from myself, that spark she induced in me, now I was proud of it. I had even written about it somewhere. I was I, and for that very reason, I could make space for her in me and give her an enduring form. She, instead, didn't want to be her, so she couldn't do the same. The tragedy of Tina, her weakened physical state, her drifting brain surely contributed to her crises. But that was the underlying cause of the illness that she called dissolving boundaries. I went to bed around 3. I woke at 9. Dede's fever was gone, but in compensation, Ima had a cough. I straightened the apartment. I went to see how Leela was. I knocked for a long time. She didn't open the door. I pressed the bell until I heard her dragging footsteps and her voice grumbling insults in dialect. Her braids were half undone. Her makeup was smeared. Even more than the day before, it was a mask with a pained expression. "Pinucha poisoned me," she said with conviction. "I couldn't sleep. My stomach is splitting." I went in. I had an impression of carelessness, of filth. On the floor, next to the sink, I saw toilet paper soaked with blood. I said, "I ate the same things you ate, and I'm fine."
"Then explain to me what's wrong with me."
"Menstruation?" She got mad.
"I'm always menstruating."
"Then you should be examined."
"I'm not going to have my stomach examined by anyone."
"What do you think is wrong?"
"I know what it is."
"I'll go get you a painkiller at the pharmacy."
"You must have something in the house."
"I don't need them."
"And Dede and Elsa?"
"They don't either."
"Ah, you're perfect. You never need anything."
I was irked. It was starting up again. "You want to quarrel?"
"You want to quarrel? Since you say I have menstrual cramps. I'm not a child like your daughters. I know if I have that pain or something else."
It wasn't true. She knew nothing about herself. When it came to the workings of her body, she was worse than Dede and Elsa. I realized that she was suffering. She pressed her stomach with her hands. Maybe I was wrong. Certainly she was overwhelmed with anguish, but not because of her old fears. She really was ill. I made her some chamomile tea, forced her to drink it. I put on a coat and went to see if the pharmacy was open. Gino's father was a skilled pharmacist. He would surely give me good advice. But I had barely emerged onto the stradone, among the Sunday stalls, when I heard explosions. Pa, 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 pa. Similar to the sound of the firecrackers the children set off at Christmas time. There were 4 close together. Then came a 5th. Pa! I turned onto the street where the pharmacy was. People seemed disoriented. Christmas was still weeks away. Some walked quickly. Some ran. Suddenly, the litany of sirens began. The police. An ambulance. I asked someone what had happened. He shook his head. He admonished his wife because she was slow and hurried off. Then I saw Carmen with her husband and two children. They were on the other side of the street. I crossed. Before I could ask a question, Carmen said in dialect, "They've killed both Saladas." 13. There are moments when what exists on the edges of our lives, and which, it seems, will be in the background forever, an empire, a political party, a faith, a monument, but also simply the people who are part of our daily existence, collapses in an utterly unexpected way, and right when countless other things are pressing upon us. This period was like that. Day after day, month after month, task was added to task, tremor to tremor. For a long time, it seemed to me that I was like certain figures in novels and paintings who stand firm on a cliff or on the prow of a ship in the face of a storm, which doesn't overwhelm them and, in fact, doesn't even touch them. My telephone rang continuously. The fact that I lived in the dominion of the Saladas compelled me to an infinite chain of words, written and spoken. After the death of her husband, my sister Elisa became a terrified child. She wanted me with her day and night. She was sure that the murderers would return to kill her and her son. And above all, I had to tend to Leela, who that same Sunday was suddenly torn from the neighborhood, from her son, from Enzo, from her job, and ended up in the hands of the doctors because she was weak. She saw things that seemed real but weren't. She was losing blood. They discovered a fibromatous uterus. They operated and took it out. Once, she was still in the hospital. She woke suddenly, exclaimed that Tina had come out of her belly again and now was taking revenge on everyone, even on her. For a fraction of a second, she was sure that the killer of the Saladas was her daughter. 14. Marcello and Michele died on a Sunday in December of 1986, in front of the church where they had been baptized. Just a few minutes after their murder, the whole neighborhood knew the details. Michele had been shot twice, Marcello three times. Giliola had run away. Her sons had instinctively followed her. Elisa had grabbed Silvio and held him tight, turning her back on the murderers. Michele had died immediately. Marcello, no. He had sat down on a step and tried to button his jacket, but couldn't. When it came to saying who had actually killed the Salado brothers, those who appeared to know everything about the murders realized they had seen almost nothing. It was a single man who fired the shots, then had got calmly into a red Ford Fiesta and left. No, there had been two men, and at the wheel of the yellow Fiat 147 in which they escaped, there was a woman. Not at all. The murderers were three men, faces covered by ski masks, and they had fled on foot. In some cases, it seemed that no one had fired the shots. In the story Carmen told me, for example, the Saladas, my sister, my nephew, Giliola, her children, became agitated in front of the church as if they had been hit by effects without cause. Michele fell to the ground backward and hit his head hard on the lava stone. Marcello sat down cautiously on a step, and since he couldn't close his jacket over the blue turtleneck sweater, he cursed and lay down on one side. The wives, the children, hadn't got even a scratch, and in a few seconds had gone into the church to hide. It seemed that those present had looked only in the direction of the killed and not that of the killers. Armando, in this situation, returned to interview me for his television station. He wasn't the only one. At that moment, I said, and recounted in writing in various places, what I knew. But in the 2 or 3 days that followed, I realized that, in particular, the reporters for the Neapolitan papers knew much more than I did. Information that until not long before could be found nowhere was suddenly flooding in. An impressive list of criminal enterprises I had never heard of were attributed to the Solara brothers. Equally impressive was the list of their assets. What I had written with Lila, what I had published when they were still alive, was nothing. Almost nothing in comparison with what appeared in the papers after their death. On the other hand, I realized that I knew other things. Things that no one knew and no one wrote. Not even me. I knew that the Solaras had always seemed very handsome to us as girls. That they went around the neighborhood in their Fiat 1100 like ancient warriors in their chariots. That one night they had defended us in Piazza dei Martiri from the wealthy youths of Chiaia. That Marcello would have liked to marry Lila, but then had married my sister Elisa. That Michele had understood the extraordinary qualities of my friend long before that, and had loved her for years in a way so absolute that he had ended up losing himself. Just as I realized that I knew these things, I discovered that they were important. They indicated how I, and countless other respectable people all over Naples, had been within the world of the Solaras. We had taken part in the opening of their businesses, had bought pastries at their bar, had celebrated their marriages, had bought their shoes, had been guests in their houses, had eaten at the same table, had directly or indirectly taken their money, had suffered their violence, and pretended it was nothing. Marcello and Michele were, like it or not, part of us, just as Pasquale was. But while in relation to Pasquale, even with innumerable distinctions, a clear line of separation could immediately be drawn. The line of separation in relation to people like the Solaras had been, and was, in Naples, in Italy, vague. The farther we jumped back in horror, the more certain it was that we were behind the line. The concreteness that being behind the line assumed in the reduced and over-familiar space of the neighborhood depressed me. Someone, to sling mud on me, wrote that I was related to the Solaras, and for a while I avoided going to see my sister and my nephew. I even avoided Lila. Of course, she had been the brother's bitterest enemy, but hadn't she gotten the money to start her little business working for Michele? Maybe stealing it from him? I wandered around that theme for a while. Then time passed. The Solaras, too, joined the many who every day ended up on the list of the murdered, and slowly what began to worry us was only that people less familiar and more violent would take their place. I forgot them to the point that when a teenage boy delivered a package from a jeweler in Monte Santo, I didn't immediately guess what it contained. The red case inside amazed me. The envelope addressed to Dottoressa Elena Greco. I had to read the note to realize what it was. Marcello had, in a laborious handwriting, written only, "Sorry," and had signed it with a swirling M of the type that used to be taught in elementary school. In the case was my bracelet, so highly polished that it seemed new. 15. When I told Lila about that package and showed her the polished bracelet, she said, "Don't wear it, and don't even let your daughters wear it." She had returned home very weak. When she went up a flight of stairs, you could hear the breath straining in her chest. She took pills and gave herself injections, but she was so pale that she seemed to have been in the kingdom of the dead and spoke of the bracelet as if she were sure that it had come from there. The death of the Saladas overlapped with her emergency admission to the hospital. The blood she had shed was mixed, in my feeling of that chaotic Sunday, with theirs. But whenever I tried to talk to her about that execution, so to speak, in front of the church, she became irritated. She reacted with remarks like, "They were shits, Lainu. Who gives a damn about them? I'm sorry for your sister, but if she had been a little smarter, she wouldn't have married Marcello. Everyone knows that people like him end up getting killed." Sometimes I tried to draw her into the sense of contiguity that at that time embarrassed me. I thought she should feel it more than I did. I said something like, "We'd known them since they were boys. All men were once boys. They gave you work. It was convenient for them, and it was convenient for me. Michele was certainly a bastard, but so were you sometimes. I should have done worse." She made an effort to limit herself to contempt, but she had a malicious look. She entwined her fingers and gripped them, making her knuckles turn white. I saw that behind those words, fierce in themselves, there were even fiercer ones that she avoided saying, but that she had ready in her mind. I read them in her face. I heard them shouted. "If it was the Saladas who took Tina away from me, then too little was done to them. They should have been drawn and quartered, their hearts ripped out and their guts dumped on the street. If it wasn't them, whoever murdered them did a good thing just the same. They deserved that and more. If the assassins had whistled, I would have hurried to give them a hand." But she never expressed herself in that way. To all appearances, the abrupt exit from the scene of the two brothers seemed to have little effect on her. Only it encouraged her to walk in the neighborhood more frequently, since there was no longer any chance of meeting them. She never mentioned returning to the activities of the time before Tina's disappearance. She never resumed the life of home and office. She made her convalescence last for weeks and weeks as she wandered around the tunnel, the stradone, the gardens. She walked with her head down. She spoke to no one. And since, partly because of her neglected appearance, she continued to seem dangerous to herself and others, no one spoke to her. Sometimes she insisted that I go with her, and it was hard to say no. We often passed the bar pastry shop, which bore a sign saying, "Closed for mourning." The mourning never ended. The shop never reopened. The time of the Saladas was over. But Lila glanced every time at the lowered shutters, the faded sign, and said with satisfaction, "It's still closed." The fact seemed to her so positive that, as we passed by, she might even give a small laugh, just a small laugh, as if in that closure there was something ridiculous. Only once did we stop at the corner, as if to take in its ugliness, now that it was without the old embellishments of the bar. Once, there had been tables and colored chairs, the fragrance of pastries and coffee, the coming and going of people, secret trafficking, honest deals and corrupt deals. Now, there was the chipped gray wall. When the grandfather died, Lila said, after their mother's murder, Marcello and Michele carpeted the neighborhood with crosses and Madonnas. They made endless lamentations. Now that they're dead, zero. Then she remembered when she was still in the clinic, and I had told her that, according to the reticent words of the people, the bullets that killed the Saladas hadn't been fired by anyone. "No one killed them," she smiled. "No one weeps for them." And she stopped and was silent for a few seconds. Then, without any obvious connection, she told me that she didn't want to work anymore. 16. It didn't seem like a random manifestation of a bad mood. Surely she had thought about it for a long time, maybe since she had left the clinic. She said, "If Enzo can do it by himself, good, and if not, we'll sell it." "You want to give up basic sight? And what will you do? Does a person necessarily have to do something? You have to use your life. The way you do? Why not?" She laughed. She sighed. "I want to waste time. You have Gennaro. You have Enzo. You have to think of them. Gennaro is 23 years old. I've been too taken up with him. And I have to separate Enzo from me. Why? I want to go back to sleeping alone. It's terrible to sleep alone. You do, don't you? I don't have a man. Why should I have one? Aren't you fond of Enzo anymore?" "Yes, but I have no desire for him or anyone. I'm old, and no one should disturb me when I sleep." "Go to a doctor. Enough with doctors. I'll go with you. Those are problems that can be solved." She became serious. "No, I'm fine like this." "No one is fine like this. I am. Fucking is very overrated. I'm talking about love. I have other things on my mind. You've already forgotten, Tina. Not me." I heard Enzo and her arguing more frequently. Rather, in the case of Enzo, only his heavy voice reached me, slightly more emphatic than usual, while Leela did nothing but scream. Only a few phrases of his reached me upstairs, filtered through the floor. He wasn't angry. He was never angry with Leela. He was desperate. In essence, he said that everything had gotten worse. Tina, the work, their relationship. But she wasn't doing anything to redefine the situation. Rather, she wanted everything to continue getting worse. "You talk to us," he said to me once. I answered that it was no use. She just needed more time to find an equilibrium. Enzo, for the first time, replied roughly, "Leela has never had any equilibrium." It wasn't true. Leela, when she wanted, could be calm, thoughtful, even in that phase of great tension. She had good days when she was serene and very affectionate. She took care of me and my daughters. She asked about my trips, about what I was writing, about the people I met. She followed, often with amusement, sometimes with indignation, the stories Dede, Elsa, even Ima told about school failures, crazy teachers, quarrels, loves. And she was generous. One afternoon, with Gennaro's help, she brought me up an old computer. She taught me how it worked and said, "I'm giving it to you." The next day, I began writing on it. I got used to it quickly, even though I was obsessed by the fear that a power outage would sweep away hours of work. Otherwise, I was excited about the machine. I told my daughters in Leela's presence, "Imagine, I learned to write with a fountain pen, then moved on to a ballpoint pen, then the typewriter, and also an electric typewriter. And finally, here I am. I tap on the keys, and this miraculous writing appears. It's absolutely beautiful. I'll never go back. I'm finished with the pen. I'll always write on the computer. Come, touch the callus I have here on my index finger. Feel how hard it is. I've always had it, but now it will disappear." Leela enjoyed my satisfaction. She had the expression of someone who is happy to have made a welcome gift. "Your mother, however," she said, "has the enthusiasm of someone who understands nothing." And she drew them away to let me work. Although she knew she had lost their confidence, when she was in a good mood, she often took them to the office to teach them what the newest machines could do, and how, and why. She said, to win them back, "Signora Elena Greco, I don't know if you know her, has the attention of a hippopotamus sleeping in a swamp, whereas you girls are very quick." But she couldn't regain their affection, in particular, Day-Day and Elsa's. The girls said to me, "It's impossible to understand what she has in mind, Mama. First, she urges us to learn, and then she says that these machines are useful for making a lot of money by destroying all the old ways of making money." Yet, while I knew how to use the computer only for writing, my daughters, and even Ima to a small extent, soon acquired knowledge and skills that made me proud. Whenever I had a problem, I began to depend especially on Elsa, who always knew what to do, and then boasted to Aunt Lena, "I fixed it like this and like that. What do you say? Was I clever?" Things went even better when Day-Day began to involve Reno. He, who had never even wanted to touch one of those objects of Enzo and Leela's, began to show some interest, if only not to be admonished by the girls. One morning, Leela said to me, laughing, "Day-Day is changing Gennaro." I answered, "Reno just needs some confidence." She replied with ostentatious vulgarity, "I know what kind of confidence he needs." 17. Those were the good days, but soon the bad ones arrived. She was hot. She was cold. She turned yellow. Then she flared up. She yelled. She demanded. She broke out in a sweat. Then she quarreled with Carmen, whom she called stupid and whiny. After the operation, her body seemed even more confused. Suddenly, she put an end to the kindnesses. She found Elsa unbearable, reprimanded Day-Day, treated Ima harshly. While I was speaking to her, she abruptly turned her back and went off. In those dark periods, she couldn't stand to be in the house and had even less tolerance for the office. She took a bus or the subway, and off she went. "What are you doing?" I asked. "I'm traveling around Naples." "Yes, but where? Do I have to account for myself to you?" Any occasion could provide a pretext for a fight. It took nothing. She quarreled mainly with her son, but ascribed the cause of their disagreements to Day-Day and Elsa. In fact, she was right. My oldest daughter happily spent time with Reno, and now her sister, in order not to feel excluded, made an effort to accept him and was often with them. The result was that both were inoculating him with a sort of permanent insubordination, an attitude that, while in their case was only a passionate verbal exercise, for Reno became confused and self-indulgent chatter that Leela couldn't bear. "Those two girls," she scolded her son, "put intelligence into it. You repeat nonsense like a parrot." In those days, she was intolerant. She wouldn't accept cliched phrases, maudlin expressions, any form of sentimentality, or, especially, the spirit of rebellion fed by old slogans. And yet, at the opportune moment, she herself displayed an affected anarchism that to me seemed out of place now. We confronted each other harshly when, at the approach of the electoral campaign of 87, we read that Nadia Galliani had been arrested in Chiasso. Carmen hurried to my house in the grip of a panic attack. She couldn't think. She said, "Now they'll seize Pasquale. You'll see. He escaped the Salatas, but the Carabinieri will murder him." Leela answered, "The Carabinieri didn't arrest Nadia. She turned herself in to bargain for a lighter sentence." That hypothesis seemed sensible to me. There were a few lines in the papers, but no talk of pursuits, shooting, capture. To soothe Carmen, I again advised her, "Pasquale would do well to turn himself in. You know what I think." All hell broke loose. Leela became furious. She began to shout, "Turn himself over to whom?" To the state.
To the state?
She made a concise list of thefts and criminal collaborations, old and new, by ministers, simple parliamentarians, policemen, judges, secret services, from 1945 until then, showing herself, as usual, more informed than I could have imagined. And she yelled,
"That is the state. Why the fuck do you want to give it Pasquale?"
Then she pushed me.
"Let's bet that Nadia does a few months in jail and comes out. Well, if they get Pasquale, they'll lock him in a cell and throw away the key."
She was almost on top of me, repeating aggressively,
"Do you want to bet?"
I didn't answer. I was worried. This sort of conversation wasn't good for Carmen. After the death of the Saladas, she had immediately withdrawn the lawsuit against me. She had done endless nice things for me. She was always available to my daughters, even if she was burdened by obligations and worries. I was sorry that instead of soothing her, we were tormenting her. She was trembling. She said, addressing me but invoking Leela's authority, "If Nadia turned herself in, Lenu, it means that she's repented, that now she's throwing all the blame on Pasquale and will get herself off. Isn't it true, Lena?" But then she spoke bitterly to Leela, invoking my authority. "It's no longer a matter of principle, Lena. We have to think of what's right for Pasquale. We have to let him know that it's better to live in prison than to be killed. Isn't it true, Lenu?" At that point, Leela insulted us grossly, and, although we were in her house, went out, slamming the door. 18. For Leela, going out, wandering around, was now the solution to all the tensions and problems she struggled with. Often she left in the morning and returned in the evening, paying no attention to Enzo, who didn't know how to deal with the clients, or to Reno, or to the commitments she made to me when I had to travel and left her my daughters. She was now unreliable. All it took was some small setback, and she dropped everything, without a thought of the consequences. Carmen maintained that Leela took refuge in the old cemetery on the Doganella, where she chose the grave of a child to think about Tina, who had no grave, and then she walked along the shaded paths amid plants, old niches, stopping in front of the most faded photographs. "The dead," Carmen said to me, "are a certainty. They have stones, the dates of birth and death, while her daughter doesn't. Her daughter will remain forever with only the date of birth. And that is terrible. That poor child will never have a conclusion, a fixed point where her mother can sit and be tranquil." But Carmen had a propensity for fantasies about death, and so I took no notice. I imagined that Leela walked through the city, paying no attention to anything, only to numb the grief that after years continued to poison her. Or I hypothesized that she really had decided, in her way, extreme as always, not to devote herself anymore to anything or anyone. And since I knew that her mind needed exactly the opposite, I feared that she would have a nervous breakdown, that at the first opportunity she would let loose against Enzo, against Reno, against me, against my daughters, against a passerby who annoyed her, against anyone who gave her an extra glance. At home, I could quarrel, calm her down, control her. But on the street? Every time she went out, I was afraid she'd get in trouble. But frequently, when I had something to do and heard the door below close and her steps on the stairs, then out in the street, I drew a sigh of relief. She wouldn't come up to me. She wouldn't drop in with provocative words. She wouldn't taunt the girls. She wouldn't disparage Ima. She wouldn't try, in every possible way, to hurt me. I went back to thinking insistently that it was time to leave. Now it was senseless for me, for Dede, for Elsa, for Ima, to remain in the neighborhood. Leela herself, besides, after her stay in the hospital, after the operation, after the imbalances of her body, had begun to say more often what she first said sporadically. Go away, Lainu. What are you doing here? Look at you. It's as if you're staying only because you made a vow to the Madonna. She wanted to remind me that I hadn't met her expectations, that my living in the neighborhood was only an intellectual pretense, that in fact for her, for the place where we were born, with all my studies, with all my books, I had been useless. I was useless. I was irritated, and I thought, she treats me as if she wanted to fire me for poor performance. 19. A period began in which I racked my brains constantly over what to do. My daughters needed stability, and I had to work hard to get their fathers to attend to them. Nino remained the bigger problem. Occasionally he telephoned, said some sweet thing to Ima on the telephone. She responded in monosyllables. That was it. Recently he had made a move that was, all in all, predictable, considering his ambitions. During the elections, he had appeared on the Socialist Party lists. For the occasion, he had sent me a letter in which he asked me to vote for him and get people to vote. In the letter, which ended with, "Tell Lena, too," he had enclosed a flyer that included an attractive photograph of him and a biographical note. Underlined in pen was a line in which he declared to the electors that he had three children, Albertino, Lydia, and Ima. Next to it, he had written, "Please read this to the child." I hadn't voted, and I had done nothing to get people to vote for him. But I had shown the flyer to Ima, and she had asked if she could keep it. When her father was elected, I explained briefly the meaning of people, elections, representation, parliament. Now he lived permanently in Rome. After his electoral success, he had been in touch only once, with a letter as hasty as it was self-satisfied, which he asked me to read to his daughter, Dede, and Elsa. No telephone number, no address, only words whose meaning was an offer of protection at a distance. Be sure that I will watch over you. But Ima also wanted to keep that testimony to her father's existence. And when Elsa said to her things like, "You're boring, that's why you're called Saratore and we're Airota," she seemed less disoriented, perhaps less worried, by having a surname that was different from that of her sister's. One day the teacher had asked her, "Are you the daughter of the Honorable Saratore?" And the next day she had brought in as proof the flyer, which she kept for any eventuality. I was pleased with that pride and planned to try to consolidate it. Nino's life was, as usual, crowded and turbulent. All right. But his daughter wasn't a rosette to use and then put back in the drawer until the next occasion. With Pietro in recent years, I had never had any problems. He contributed money for his daughter's maintenance punctually. From Nino, I had never received a lira, and was, as far as possible, a conscientious father. But not long ago, he had broken up with Doriana. He was tired of Florence. He wanted to go to the United States. And, stubborn as he was, he would manage it. That alarmed me. I said to him, "You'll abandon your daughters." And he replied, "It seems a desertion now, but you'll see. Soon it will be an advantage for them especially." He was probably right, in that his words had something in common with Nino's. Be sure that I will watch over you. In fact, however, Dede and Elsa too would remain without a father. And if Ima had always done without, Dede and Elsa clung to Pietro. They were used to having recourse to him when they wanted. His departure would sadden and limit them, that I was sure.